Thank you. The only trouble with such an introduction is that it makes it harder to give the talk. One bit of physics that most of you have seen in high school, if you've studied any physics at all, is the inverse square law of gravity and electricity, which was originally discovered by Newton by comparing the Earth's force on the moon, which causes the moon to orbit the Earth, to the Earth's force on an apple, by which the apple falls to the ground. And also, by thinking about what kind of gravitational force would be needed to obtain Kepler's laws of planetary motion. And then 100 years later, it was appreciated that a quite similar force law holds for gravity, for electricity, I mean, for the force between two electrically charged bodies. The inverse square law says that the force between two charges that are separated by distance r, or likewise between two masses separated by distance r, is the product of the two charges, E1, E2, or the product of the two masses, M1, M2, in that case with Newton's constant, divided by r squared, where r is the distance between them. Those are our only equations for tonight, by the way. Just to urge you to relax. But I did want to let you put to good use your knowledge of whatever knowledge of physics you may have. So, physics practically began, or physics in the modern sense practically began, with Newton's discovery of the inverse square law for gravity, and then one of the most fundamental advances of the next century was the similar law for electricity. And it has a lot of interesting properties, but one of its properties that caused the greatest attention in the last century, but probably did not cause great headaches to Newton, was the fact that according to this formula, the force between two masses is extremely large if the distance is extremely small. In fact, this quantity, 1 over r squared, would become nearly infinite if r is extremely small. That didn't really bother Newton because the moon was always at a safe distance from the Earth. And even with this apple falling downwards to the Earth, the r here is really the distance to the center of the Earth. And his apples were safely far from the center of the Earth. And in fact, everything was fine with this for the first 200 years or so of the inverse square law. The trouble really only began about a century ago when the electron was discovered. And shortly after that, the nucleus. Because it was very soon clear that atoms were at least roughly to be described in terms of electrons orbiting around the nucleus, a little bit like the planets orbit the sun. But if you think in those terms, you quickly run into trouble, into the singularity I mentioned, the bad behavior of the inverse square law when the distance r becomes nearly zero. Because a small calculation showed, for example, in the case of an atom, that if you treat the electron as a little charge orbiting around the nucleus, an atom should only last for about 10 to the minus 9 seconds before, drawn in by the extremely small force that it experiences when it's close to the nucleus, the electron would spiral into the nucleus. Well, a lot of physics in this century had to do with grappling with that predicament. So first of all, in the case of electricity, at least if we ignore issues raised by relativity, the problem was solved in the first quarter, or first half of the century, to include some relativity, with the development of quantum mechanics. Well, how did quantum mechanics solve the problem of the electron spiraling into the nucleus? Not, for example, in a brutal way, by saying that the inverse square law wasn't correct if the distances involved were too small, which might be the most obvious thought that the question would suggest. The answer turned out to be a lot more subtle and is based on something called the uncertainty principle. The uncertainty principle says that everything is a little bit fuzzy if you try to express it in classical terms. So, if you don't look too closely at a proton or an electron, you can treat them classically. But if you try to look at it, classically means, roughly speaking, on the basis of common sense. So your ordinary common sense notions that a particle at a given time has a definite position and a definite velocity. And if you know what they are, you can figure out what will happen afterwards. the ordinary common sense notions work fine if you don't look too closely. But when you look very closely at an electron or a proton or any other subatomic particle, you find that there's what's called a quantum uncertainty principle that makes everything fuzzy in a way that really can't be described properly on the basis of ordinary intuition. But mathematically, the effect of this fuzziness is that you don't really see what would happen at r equals zero, because long before you've really met the problem, you have to deal with that quantum mechanical fuzziness. The microphone is working. Can you hear in the back? What? It's on, as far as I can see. Okay. Well, I'll speak louder. Is that better in the back? Okay. A little bit? Okay. Well, anyway, quantum mechanical uncertainty resolved the problem for electricity in the early part of this century, but perhaps rather surprisingly, was not powerful enough to solve the problem for gravity. There's a close analogy between the two forces, which seemed almost perfect before the 20th century. But in the 20th century, it became clear that the analogy between electricity and gravity, although very close, is not quite as close as the inverse square law suggests. One learned early in the century, with Einstein's greatest discovery, really, Einstein's greatest discovery, which was completed in 1915, was that gravity has to do with the curvature of space and time caused by mass. And the motion, the distortion of the motion of other masses because of the curvature produced by a given mass. So in basing gravity on the curvature of space and time, Einstein introduced some very subtle nonlinear mathematics in the description of gravity, which left the inverse square law as a good approximation under ordinary conditions. But if you look more closely, it changed all the concepts drastically. If you're planning to navigate in the solar system, whether you need to know general relativity or you can make do with the inverse square law depends on how precise you want your calculations to be, you'll make an error of a few kilometers per orbit if you just use the inverse square law. If you want to be able to calculate and plan your trajectory more accurately than that, you should study general relativity and learn about the curvature of the solar system, due primarily to the mass of the sun. Anyway, in general relativity, it was based on nonlinear mathematics, which changes physics in a lot of ways, but one aspect which is important tonight is that quantum uncertainty alone cannot solve the problems of the inverse square law. Well, this problem is very much at the center of physics because the two theories that I've mentioned so far are really the main theories upon which our present understanding of physics is based. On the one hand, we have quantum mechanics, which was invented because of this problem of the inverse square law. It's the theory by which we understand atoms and molecules and subatomic particles and so on. And on the other hand, we have general relativity, which is Einstein's theory of gravity, his theory of the curvature of space and time and the large-scale behavior of the universe. One is applied to very small objects and the other is applied to very large objects, but they're in marked conflict because the nonlinear mathematics of general relativity makes it impossible to use quantum mechanics to tame the problems of the inverse square law. And in fact, the two theories just don't work together in any standard way. If you try to combine them, you run into a web of contradictions. Well, this conflict is really the contemporary version of earlier conflicts which shaped many of the upheavals in 20th century physics. I mentioned one, which was the role of the inverse square law of trouble in leading to quantum mechanics, but there were many others. Einstein invented special relativity because Newtonian mechanics was in conflict with the theory of electricity and light. And then he invented general relativity because Newton's laws of gravity were in conflict with his own theory of special relativity. And closer to our own times, the weak an important part of the standard model, the weak interaction part, was invented essentially, once again, because of the contradiction involving the 1 over r squared force law for the weak interactions. So conflicts like this between different branches of physics have been one of the most fruitful starting points for progress in this century. And the most striking such conflict nowadays is surely the one I've mentioned between gravity and quantum mechanics. Well, I think it's a problem that has yielded little to direct result. And had physicists not been lucky, I suspect it would be a problem that would not be under fruitful study in the 1990s. But physicists had the good luck to discover, essentially in the 70s, or starting in the late 60s, that this problem can be overcome in string theory. Well, what's string theory? Roughly speaking, in string theory, you reinterpret an elementary particle not as a little point particle, but as a vibrating loop of string. Well, it's a very rough description because on both sides you have to remember quantum mechanics. So on each side you should include quantum mechanical uncertainty. So the particle is a fuzzy particle and the string is a fuzzy string. But nevertheless, you've got a little vibrating string, and try to think of that temporarily as your model for what an elementary particle is. Well, an important property of these strings is that, like a violin or a piano string, one of these strings has many different modes or harmonics of oscillation. The reason that a violin or a piano sound different, even if you play the same note, or for that matter, the reason that either of them sounds different from a tuning fork, is that the violin or piano string have many different harmonics of oscillation. If you play middle C, you also see its higher harmonics. And you hear the different harmonics in different proportions, depending on whether you play one instrument or another, which is the reason that music is played with symphony orchestras and not just on tuning forks, where the higher harmonics are avoided. So in the case of music, the richness and beauty depend almost completely on the existence of the higher harmonics. And in the case of string theory, the existence of many different harmonics, in this case the different harmonics are all interpreted as elementary particles, and the key to unification of the different particles is that the different particles, the photon, the electron, and so on, the quarks, the muons, the neutrinos, all the funny things that you've heard of or haven't heard of, they're interpreted as different states of oscillation of one basic string. The different harmonics are interpreted as different elementary particles. So, all at once, a single string describes a huge assortment of different particles. Once you learn to correctly quantize the string, that means once you learn to study strings in the light of quantum mechanics, and calculate the spectrum, which means to understand all those different harmonics and what particles you get out of them, you find, among quite a number of surprises, what I think is one of the most great discoveries in the history of physics, and which, incidentally, I was also too young to participate in, which is that one of the harmonics of the string has just the right properties to be the graviton, or in other words, the quantum of gravitational waves. This is something that physicists were very reluctant to believe, and perhaps literally hundreds, certainly dozens, and perhaps hundreds of papers were written in an attempt to avoid this conclusion, which string theorists finally, dragging and kicking, ended up accepting. And this discovery about one of the vibrational modes or harmonics of the string was the beginning of the discovery that, in contrast to conventional quantum field theory, which makes gravity impossible, string theory requires gravity. It's not just that the contradiction between quantum mechanics and gravity can possibly be solved if you adopt string theory as a new framework for physics. What initially became clear in the 70s was that in this new framework of physics, gravity, understood in the sense of general relativity, is not just possible, but necessary. It's forced on you. And as I've said, other modes of the string look a lot like the particles that we know, although we don't know how to make it work precisely. And so, with very simple assumptions, everything neatly and at least more or less fits into a string. In a way that doesn't fit the details of what we see in nature, but which certainly, in a very attractively elegant fashion, describes the main points of elementary particle physics as we see it. Well, the step of going from point particles to strings sounds so naive that at first sight it surely is difficult to believe it leads to anything deep. And I hope that was your reaction, since alternatively I would have to suspect that you weren't listening closely. For a simple explanation of why going from point particles to strings has fateful consequences, I'd like to begin by going back and telling you a little bit more about standard quantum theory. Well, according to Feynman, Feynman introduced one of his most well-remembered discoveries, a very intuitive way of calculating what will happen in different physical processes in standard quantum theory, in terms of what came to be called Feynman diagrams. So, not in the fancy way that's usually presented in textbooks where they're telling you how to do technical calculations, but in the intuitive way that Feynman originally thought about it, a Feynman diagram is something like this. It's a space-time history. So I've plotted time vertically and space goes horizontally. And this is a space-time history in which some particles come in from the past and they go out to the future after being scattered. And the way the scattering happens is a succession of events in space and time. Particle A perhaps propagates to a space-time moment X, where it breaks up into two particles, one of which later joins with incoming particle B and goes out propagating to W, where after some further branching and joining, final particles go out, which I've labeled C and D in the drawing. I've sketched an example where two come in and two go out, but we could easily have, for instance, two going in and four going out, which is one of the characteristic properties of standard quantum field theory, that the number of particles isn't constant. Matter can be created and annihilated. In this illustration, though, two particles come in the past and four go out in the future. So we've created matter. But anyway, whether matter is created or not, we compute such processes by summing or integrating over all of these space-time histories. So, as I've said, the lines in a Feynman diagram represent the free propagation of particles. Free just means that the particle is propagating with nothing happening to it. So I drew straight lines to make the previous picture easy to visualize. But in quantum mechanics, different trajectories are possible. So here I've drawn a wiggly one. But whatever it is, as long as you just see a line, a particle is propagating. It's a free particle. Nothing's happening to it. But the vertices in the diagram, where one line fork into two or two forks join into one, those are the interaction events, the interaction vertices, as they're called technically. They're the interaction events where particles branch and rejoin. You should think of those as the space-time moments where something happens. So at this space-time event or at this space-time event, something happens. In this diagram, in the past, there was one particle. In the future, there are two. And that's the very moment in space-time where it changed. Well, there are lots of great things about quantum theory, of which I mentioned one, which was the fantastic and brilliantly vindicated prediction that matter gets created and annihilated. And equally important is the fact that the Feynman diagram technique led to fantastically accurate and precise calculations, enabling one to verify standard quantum field theory with an incredible precision to within one part in a billion or better in some cases. But at the same time, this description makes it possible to see some of the limitations of standard quantum theory. One of the most important limitations is that there are too many theories. Because, first of all, you can be rather arbitrary about what particles are propagating in these lines. But even worse, there are many, many theories that differ by what kind of vertices one allows, which kind of special interaction events are permitted. In my drawings, to keep them simple, I only considered the case where one particle breaks up into two. But, well, nature shows us that in elaborating the interesting theories we discover, that we need to allow more complicated vertices, 2 going to 3 or 2 going to 2 and so on. And you end up having many, many theories differing by what kind of special interaction events are allowed. The other thing is the infinities of quantum field theory, the mathematical troubles that you run into, which we call infinities, the fact that often when you do calculations you don't get sensible answers. The infinities, which ultimately make gravity impossible, arise because in this space-time history there were special moments, x, y, z, and w, and Feynman taught us that you should integrate sum of all possibilities. You should allow all possibilities for what x, y, z, and w were. And in particular, you could have a traffic jam where everything happens at the same space-time moment. And that leads to acute troubles, which ultimately make it impossible to have gravity in the light of quantum mechanics, which are the souped-up relativistic version of the old problem of the inverse square law. So the inverse square law was the trouble that two particles could meet, and the relativistic version is that all these events could meet in space-time. Well, these are the limitations which you would like to circumvent, and you circumvent them in string theory in the following way. First of all, instead of a propagating point particle, you have a little propagating string. So here I've drawn once again the space-time picture of a propagating point particle. At each moment in time, the particle is somewhere in space. And as time unfolds, it travels at a later time at somewhere else. And I've indicated its trajectory in space-time by drawing a curve. For the string instead, at each moment in time, you have a string, or I'll draw a little closed loop, somewhere in space. As time goes on, the string propagates in space, and it sweeps out a little tube in space called the world tube, just as the particle sweeps out a world line, or curve. So the Feynman diagram that I drew has to be redrawn with tubes instead of lines. Now, lines can't very well meet smoothly. They have to branch and rejoin in the fashion of a standard Feynman diagram. But tubes have the property that they can meet and rejoin in a perfectly smooth fashion, which I've drawn here, as if some plumber maybe has connected different tubes. So now, this picture will look a lot like this one if viewed from a big distance, which is more or less the intuitive idea for why string theory can look like standard quantum theory if you aren't able to do sufficiently precise measurements. But if you look closely, it's completely different. And in particular, the vertices or distinguished space-time events of standard quantum theory have disappeared. Every sufficiently small picture, piece of this picture is just a little smooth piece of a two-dimensional world tube and looks just like any other small piece. In contrast to this picture, where if I draw a little circle around an interaction event, no matter how small that circle is, it really looks different from a little piece where nothing happens. One of them contains a fork and one didn't. But here, any sufficiently small piece has nothing happening in it. It just has free propagation. Pre-motion. And since the vertices led to all the troubles, we might reasonably hope, and we ultimately discover, that the troubles go away. There are very few theories, and the few theories that we have, well, they're finite, they don't have the traditional mathematical contradictions, and that means in particular that there's no problem with the inverse square law. The statement that there are very few theories means, to be precise, that once you understand what you mean by a free string, once you understand what this picture means, that just describes free motion of a string with nothing happening, you automatically understand how the strings are going to interact, how they're going to behave, scatter each other and decay and so on. All the phenomena that will occur. Because, as I said already, these two pictures look locally the same. A small piece of one looks like a small piece of the other. So if you understand this one where nothing is happening, you understand this one where, in fact, something is happening. One string is breaking into two. This contrasts, as I've tried to stress, with field theory, with standard quantum theory, where after you understand the free motion, you still must describe the interactions or vertices. So, for this and other more or less related reasons, there aren't many string theories. And by the time the dust had cleared, more than a decade ago, it was clear that there were five possible relativistic string theories, which differ by very general properties of what kind of strings you've got. In type 1, these strings are electrical insulators, and they can be either open or closed strings. But if they're open strings, they have electric charge at the ends of the strings. In the two type 2 theories, the strings are electrical insulators with no charges, with closed strings only. And in the two heterotic theories, the strings are actually electrical superconductors, which can carry vast, vast currents. They'd be extremely useful technologically because of their huge current carrying ability and superconducting properties, except that unfortunately their large tension would make them a little bit hard to manage for industrial purposes. Well, the existence of five string theories is a vast, vast improvement over the standard state of affairs in ordinary quantum theory, where there are infinitely many possible theories. But it still raised an obvious question. It's marvelous to learn that there is a rich new framework of physics where the traditional difficulties of quantum mechanics and gravity are overcome. And there only are five of them. But five is four too many. And if one of them describes our world, then who lives in the other four worlds? But in the mid-80s, that question was too difficult, so we'll leave it aside for a bit. Well, reducing in this way the number of theories has a fateful consequence for our general understanding of physics. I have trouble explaining this in a completely non-mathematical terms, but in standard physics, when you talk about the free motion of a particle in space-time, you can describe it abstractly. I drew a picture as if the particle is moving in space-time. But you can really describe it abstractly, and as long as nothing is happening, you don't learn very much about space-time. But once interactions are occurring, once there's a distinguished space-time event at which something actually happens, then you've got some definite knowledge about space and time. The interactions depend on knowing exactly where you are. And in our diagrams, where we really talk about a definite space-time event, is where something happens. But in string theory, that last bit, which is where you really learn what space-time is absent. And as a result, you never really learn precisely what the space-time is. There's a certain kind of fuzziness that affects your notion of space-time, just as early in the century, a certain kind of quantum fuzziness came to affect many classical notions or common sense notions of the trajectory of a particle. So you get a new source of fuzziness, a little bit like quantum fuzziness, but going beyond it. So quantum mechanical fuzziness is controlled by Planck's constant, and the stringy fuzziness is controlled by a new constant called alpha prime that controls the typical size of the smallest allowed strings. So quantum mechanics put a limit or bound on how precisely you can talk about some of your common sense notions, like a particle's position or velocity. And string theory puts a bound on how precisely you can describe space-time. Well, once you attempt to reformulate physics in terms of string theory, you're led to several very general predictions, which I'll explain a little bit more in a moment, especially the third of them. But they are, in brief, gravity, gauge symmetry, and supersymmetry. And apart from these general predictions, if you manage to understand the vacuum, which is where our understanding is severely limited, you could aspire to learn a lot more. To try to make a very rough analogy, when standard quantum field theory was developed, there was one very general prediction that was, I think, roughly analogous to these three, which was that antimatter should exist. But with certain, the idea is that every particle has a corresponding antiparticle, and matter and antimatter can be created and annihilated, turning into or being created from pure energy and radiation. So this was a very striking prediction, which was vindicated almost immediately. So standard quantum field theory makes this general prediction, and in addition, if you understand specific quantum field theories, as we learn to in the decades following the invention of quantum theory in the 20s, you can make much more specific and detailed predictions. So, in a similar spirit that this framework for physics made a very general prediction, string theory as a framework for physics makes several general predictions, something which is possible because it greatly, by eliminating those interaction events and making the interactions things that are determined by the knowledge of the free motion, it greatly increases the predictive power. It leads to three general predictions. And as I've said, it leaves you with a tantalizing hope, which is really not fully realized, that if you could understand what the vacuum is, you could learn a lot more. That's analogous to saying that, in this case, if you have a specific theory, you can learn a lot more. Well, our three predictions, which I promise to tell you more about, are gravity, well, which I've really already mentioned. Gravity here means Einstein's theory of general relativity that describes gravity in terms of the curvature of space-time. And as I've already told you, it's automatic in string theory, while impossible in standard quantum field theory. That surely is the single most important reason for the intense interest physicists have had in string theory in the last generation. The second general prediction is what's called gauge symmetry. And I don't really have time tonight to tell you too much about gauge symmetry, but it's the bread and butter of the standard model of particle physics. It has its roots in the 19th century Maxwell theory of electricity, magnetism, and light. And the standard model was developed where, when new kinds of gauge theories were understood and extended and explored to describe first radioactivity, that is, the weak interactions, and then the nuclear forces or strong interactions. Well, these two general predictions, so to speak, of string theory are in a sense really post-predictions, because here on planet Earth, general relativity and gauge symmetry predate their appearance in string theory. It may well be different on other planets, and there may be planets, for example, where string theory was developed a little earlier and physicists are a little bit more sluggish with non-abelian gauge symmetry, and maybe where they consider gauge symmetry to be largely a consequence of string theory. But here on planet Earth, the two predictions that I've mentioned really predate string theory. And the third is therefore particularly exciting because we in fact don't yet know if it's true. It's a real prediction coming from string theory. The third general prediction is supersymmetry, which is a new kind of symmetry of elementary particles, which physicists hope to discover in accelerators, perhaps within the next decade, or even earlier if we're quite lucky. Supersymmetry says roughly the following. While we're accustomed to measuring space and time by numbers, space and time are classical concepts that require no special 20th century equipment to detect them. And related to that, we measure space and time by ordinary numbers, which are again classical concepts. It's now 3 o'clock, we're 200 meters above sea level, and so on. And when Einstein developed special relativity, or even general relativity, quantum mechanics wasn't yet known. And space and time were conceived entirely in terms of ordinary classical variables. It's practically the one area of physics that wasn't touched until the present by the development of quantum mechanics. But according to supersymmetry, supersymmetry is the beginning of a quantum structure of space-time. In addition to the ordinary variables, the 3 o'clock and the 200 meters above sea level, by which you measure space and time, there would be new infinitesimal quantum variables, or Fermi dimensions in space-time, which you really can't describe in terms of ordinary familiar concepts. They're quantum mechanical in nature, just as an electron is quantum mechanical in nature. Whereas space and time, as traditionally described, are more like classical variables like light waves that you can detect with pre-20th century equipment and measure by numbers. So supersymmetry is a kind of new structure in space-time, but in down-to-earth terms, if it's correct, it predicts the existence of new elementary particles that involve oscillations of ordinary particles in the new fermionic dimensions, which we would see in accelerators as new elementary particles. As I've already stressed, in contrast to gravity and gauge invariance, we don't yet know if the third general prediction of string theory is true. It's one of the main targets of accelerators, including the unfortunately defunct SLC, and including the LHC, which is the Large Hadron Collider, which is a somewhat lower energy version of the SLC, which will be operating in Geneva around 2005, and which the US has recently committed itself to participating in. As well as in the lower energy accelerators that are operating currently. There are some experimental hints that supersymmetry is very near. One of the most striking ones is that a slight elaboration of the notion of supersymmetry, called supersymmetric grand unification, makes a detailed prediction about the values that you should see for the so-called coupling constants of the interactions that we know. And this prediction is very accurately tested in accelerator experiments, which gives a strong hint that supersymmetry may well be correct and very near in energy. If it were found, well, in many aspects, it would be a very momentous discovery, the beginning of understanding the quantum structure in space-time, and among many other things, it would give a tremendous boost to string theory, which is where the concept originated. Well, so far I've given you a more or less unrelated survey of good news, but at some point I have to be honest and tell you a bit of bad news too. So one bit of bad news, which I find particularly pressing, is that there's a basic problem in physics that has to do with quantum mechanics and gravity, which has to do with something that was called the cosmological constant, introduced by Einstein. It's the energy of the vacuum. And if it's not zero, it would show up in nature by the fact that when you measure the angles of a triangle, they won't add up to 180 degrees as you learned they do in high school, but you'll get something a little bit different. So the most accurate observation in nature is that the cosmological constant is either zero or else incredibly small. In its natural units, after the decimal point, the first 120 digits are zero, at least. And Astronomers are hard at work measuring the 121st digit. With some experimental evidence at the moment that it's not zero. But I think I'm one of those who suspect that we aren't lucky people who have exactly living at the right time so that we can just barely measure the 121st digit, which is the first one that isn't zero. So I think I would suspect it's zero. But whether it's zero or merely fantastically small, the cosmological constant is a mystery about quantum mechanics and gravity, because the energy of the vacuum only matters when you've got gravity, general relativity. It produces a large-scale curvature in space-time, which is the reason that the angles don't add up to 180 degrees in a triangle. And it's quantum mechanics that makes it really difficult to explain why it's zero. And since string theory is the only theory of quantum gravity that makes any sense, string theory is the only framework where this is a well-defined problem. And therefore, it's incumbent upon string theorists to explain why it vanishes or is fantastically small, and they haven't. It's not just a big embarrassment, but I must say that my strong intuition is that not understanding this is the main roadblock to making models of particle physics derived from string theory more realistic. Well, that's one aspect of the bad news, but, well, on a more cosmic scale, there's even worse news, which is that even after a generation of work, we still don't understand what the theory is. I think that's really hard to explain, even to a general audience of scientists, much less to the general public, because scientists don't ordinarily work for a generation on a theory without knowing what it is. It has to do with the peculiar history where the theory was discovered by accident in the course of physicists working on quite different problems. And they discovered formulas that were valuable and important, but not the most valuable and important formulas in the theory. And since then, for a generation, we've had no choice but to try to work gradually backwards, probing more deeply and understanding the more basic structures from which the amazing things that were discovered came. To try to very roughly describe our predicaments, I could say that, well, physics can be described in terms of particles, which is actually the language I've used mostly because it's more intuitive. But at a deeper level, physics is described in quantum mechanics in terms of waves, which are then quantized to give particles. So both descriptions are important, but the waves in many ways are more fundamental. But string theory began historically by generalizing the less fundamental particle viewpoints. And we've been having to cope with that lucky but nevertheless awkward start ever since. So, well, a picture that those who have heard my previous colloquial or popular talks on string theory have undoubtedly seen is this one. Here I've plotted the particle view of physics, and here's the more fundamental wave view. And horizontally, I've drawn sort of old pre-string physics. And at the bottom is the new physics, which maybe if it hadn't been discovered till the 20th century, physicists would have discovered it when they were ready for it, and they wouldn't have spent a generation studying it without knowing what it is. But our good luck as 20th century physicists of being able to study it at all, by its lucky discovery at a premature time when we probably weren't ready to understand it, has had the corollary that we've been grappling with it in this awkward way. Anyway, that's what I've indicated as the new physics. Well, the particle I've symbolized in old physics by a point particle that travels at the speed of light, because the basic ones do that, or all of them do that in some good approximation. And the speed of light I've symbolized by a 45-degree angle to the horizontal. In going to the new physics, that simple straight line at a 45-degree angle is replaced by a vibrating world tube. See, there's a lot of physics in this point particle that travels at the speed of light. But much deeper are the concepts of general relativity and the standard model, the gauge theories, from which this is derived. And just as general relativity and gauge theory contain much greater truths than the straight line at a 45-degree angle to the horizontal, someone would believe that the synthesis down here contains much greater truths than the vibrating world tube. And trying to understand what really belongs in that box is the mystery of what is string theory, which physicists have grappled with a lot for a long time. Well, the problem, as I've just posed it, is not new. It's been with us for many years. But the outlook has changed a lot, as David alluded to in his introduction. In the last few years, because of understanding of a new kind of symmetry called duality. Very roughly, duality is just a relation between different things that look like they couldn't possibly be related, but turned out to be. If a new symmetry, a new way of relating different things, is sufficiently surprising, then it gets dignified by the name of duality. If it's too easy to understand, it doesn't rate. In its oldest form, duality is a symmetry between electric and magnetic fields, which holds in vacuum. That means it holds in the absence of electric charges and currents. But it's spoiled in nature by the fact that we see electrons, but we don't see magnetic monopoles. A magnetic monopole would be a magnetic north pole without a south pole, or vice versa. We don't see those. We've got bar magnets, and as has been known since ancient times, if you try to separate the north and south pole of a bar magnet by breaking it, you don't get separate magnets with only one pole. You just get littler bar magnets that have both north and south poles. So for electricity, you can get a minus charge without a plus charge, or vice versa. But for magnetism, you never get a north pole without a south pole. So although in some ways there's a very close symmetry between electricity and magnetism, it seems to be hopelessly spoiled in nature by the fact that there are electrons but no monopoles. Well, in the early part of the century, it seemed that one of the triumphs was a better understanding that this symmetry, which had tempted 19th century physicists, was not just absent but impossible. Because quantum mechanics was set up in terms of something called the vector potential that seemed to make a symmetry between electricity and magnetism impossible. Nevertheless, in the 70s, there was a remarkable insight about how you might get duality in quantum theory after all. Yet for many years, it seemed completely out of reach to determine if this attempt to resurrect the electromagnetic symmetry was true. It seemed out of reach because of one of the main limitations in our abilities in physics, which is thoroughly drummed into us, I might say, in our graduate student days. We're generally able to compute what happens only when the charge E, you can think of E as being the charge of the electron, when the charge E is much less than 1. Sometimes, but only when you've got very special techniques, you can calculate when that isn't true. But basically, you're limited in physics to computing what happens when E is much less than 1. Well, the way that the idea of duality was rescued was by discovering that duality should exchange E with 1 over E. But now the one mathematical fact I'll draw upon on your behalf, on your part for the rest of this talk, is that E and 1 over E cannot both be much less than 1. If E is very little, then 1 over E is very big. And so, if you can calculate in terms of electricity, then you can't calculate in terms of magnetism. And so you can't figure out if a conjectured symmetry between them is true, or so it seems. And so for many years, visionaries who speculated about such symmetries were just visionaries. Well, as I stressed, to learn if these new symmetries are correct, you have to somehow get beyond the traditional limitation of small e, which is what's happened in the last few years with very broad implications, not just for string theory, but even for our understanding of standard quantum theory. For standard quantum theory, we've gotten new insights about traditional problems of physics, such as quark confinement. Quark confinement is a very surprising phenomenon, but you can understand protons, neutrons, and the like much better by interpreting them as being made out of quarks, yet you never see an individual quark. We understand that to be that if you try to separate a quark from an antiquark, or if you try to separate likewise a quark from other quarks in a proton, the energy grows until something else happens instead. So we know, well, experiments strongly indicate that this is true, and computer tests have shown that it's true, and there are a variety of theoretical arguments going back to the 70s, but there's still a basic and important element at which it's much less understood than we'd like to understand such a fundamental phenomenon. Well, the dualities have given some new insight about them, because they relate this rather mysterious phenomenon of quark confinement to more standard physics, such as the behavior of a superconductor in a magnetic field, which we understand much better. For string theory, the implications have perhaps been even more far-reaching. For one thing, we've obtained the amazing insight that there's only one theory. You know, we thought there were, well, in the past we thought there were five string theories. I listed them before and mentioned how they differed by whether the strings were conducting or insulating and so on. But we now understand that what we understood in the past as five different theories, raising the mystery, I stressed, of who lives in the other four worlds, were different aspects of one theory which is even richer than we thought. It's as if one group of physicists was studying the nose of the elephant, one group was studying the tail, another bunch was studying the ears, and two more bunches were studying the front legs and the hind legs, without suspecting that the five different phenomena that they were investigating were different aspects of one elephant. We now understand that the six theories, so I've called them five theories because there were five theories that made sense, five string theories. There was a cousin which to most of us seemed like a near miss, including me, but which some of our colleagues always had faith would somehow be resurrected, which is called 11-dimensional supergravity. I won't quite have time to explain what it is. So in the quest for superunification of the laws of nature, in the last generation or so, physicists have really been studying six different theories. And we now understand, via these new duality symmetries, that these six different theories are limiting cases of one theory. To understand this, you've got to crack the small e barrier, since for small e, the theories are really different. So I've tried to plot this schematically here. Well, in the center is the elephant, M theory, the mysterious theory which we're still trying to understand. And then out on the periphery are six different things they can reduce to in different limits where one or another parameter becomes small. This is a simplification, but you can imagine that the parameters I sketched are Planck's constant and the stringy constant, which parameterize quantum and stringy effects. And what combination of them is E, which causes all the trouble, depends on which theory you're eventually going to look at. So this two parameter, this richer theory, can reduce in appropriate limits to any of the theories studied previously. And a type 2b string theorist, for example, since he was limited to small e, was only able to study just a little corner of reality. And if you ask him, well, what happens if e isn't small, his answer was, I don't know. As we learned in graduate school, you just can't calculate what happens when e isn't small under most conditions. And similarly, a hadronic E8 times E8 theorist was studying what we now understand as a corner of richer world, and similarly in the dark about what happens when E isn't small. What we've now understood is that if you get past the small E barrier in any one of these theories, you discover the other five theories. The six theories discovered in different ways and studied by physicists in the last generation and looking for superunification are different limiting cases of this one richer theory. In the process of learning that the traditional theories are different limits of one elephant, we've also obtained a rather different view of the basic ingredients of string theory. In a sense, strings are only the first among equals in string theory. They are the first among equals because something very important is that you can calculate systematically with strings in a way that you can't do with their cousins. But at a deeper level that we've now penetrated to, we see that if you look more closely, strings are just the first among equals, and they share the stage, for example, with miniature black holes called D-brains that we've come to know about only very recently. So, in the process of understanding that the strings are only the first among equals, we've had to, well, they've had to share the stage, and the new objects they've shared the stage with are very interesting in their own right, because they are a kind of miniature black hole, and understanding them has actually led us to a better understanding of quantum black holes. There are long-standing mysteries about physics raised by the existence of black holes. Because, for instance, according to Einstein's theory, a black hole is something that absorbs matter and can't emit matter. It's black. It looks like a hole in space. Nothing comes out. But that notion actually contradicts the very ideas of quantum mechanics. Because quantum mechanics, at a very deep level, requires that if something can go in, then something else can come out. So, physicists have long puzzled about this. It's a problem that, like the cosmological constant, only makes sense in a quantum theory of gravity. And therefore, the problem only makes sense in string theory. And one of our embarrassments until the last couple of years is that although we had a theory where we should address this question, we hadn't. But by learning about the D-brains, which are sort of elementary constituents or building blocks of a black hole, we've now been able to understand something about quantum black holes and to address at least some of the mysteries. Quantum black holes are one example, but you see, another, when I talk about combining quantum mechanics and gravity, you might well ask, well, what question is that you might wonder about on a starry night while you're staring out into the clear skies? It depends on combining quantum mechanics and gravity. And perhaps I'd like to leave you with the thought that such a problem is the very nature of the Big Bang. So, astronomers have observed that the universe is expanding. As far as we can see, that expansion began with an explosion, which we call the Big Bang. But the very mention of the Big Bang appears to raise paradoxes that you might puzzle out about with no particular scientific training at all. If there was a Big Bang, what was there before the Big Bang? How were the clocks started, and so on? These are really all questions about quantum gravity, because both quantum mechanics and gravity would have been important near the Big Bang. And I think most physicists believe that the answers have something to do with the fact that the notion of time is fuzzy, and while the fuzziness won't keep you from looking at your watch and getting a measure of time that will be sufficiently good for your present-day purposes, that fuzziness about the notion of time is very important near the Big Bang. As you got closer to the Big Bang, the very notion of time breaks down. And I think ultimately, most physicists would guess, questions like what there was before the Big Bang won't make any sense, because the notion of before and after won't make any sense near the Big Bang. Whether that's true or not, I can't guarantee, because while we've learned enough to say a little bit about black holes, although not as much as we'd like, we haven't learned enough to address the Big Bang. And the reason, incidentally, again, has to do with the small e barrier. We've addressed the small e barrier for questions where the time dependence isn't very important, but that isn't the case for the Big Bang. Looking ahead, the big question to me is whether or not, with our new understanding, we're finally well placed to answer the big question of what is string theory. It's hard to know because we did discover string theory, well, almost 30 years ago, at a time when the ideas needed to understand it were far from being in place. And we've been peeling off layers of the onion ever since, and it's really hard to know how many more there are. We may be close to finally understanding what is string theory, and it could equally well, I think, be another 30 years down the road. But I do feel that whether it's sooner or later, if we would finally understand what is string theory, a lot of the things I've mentioned to you this evening would become a lot clearer. Thank you.
invited to answer questions. Yeah?
My understanding is that Einstein invented the cosmological energy constant to keep the universe from collapsing,
yeah.
Not knowing that discovered
later on. Right.
And then he said it was his greatest blunder.
Yes.
Discovered. Now, why is this being brought back?
Well, you see, Einstein carried out the discussion without quantum mechanics. And without quantum mechanics, he could just say, let the cosmological constant be zero. But quantum mechanics doesn't allow you to just say, let it be zero, especially not in a theory like string theory, which has no adjustable parameters. I didn't stress that in the talk. It's a unique theory which either has to agree with nature or not agree with nature. So as a string theorist, you've got to just calculate the cosmological constant. You don't have Einstein's luxury of saying, I think it should have been zero. And we don't understand why the calculation would give zero to 120 decimal places. We do incidentally understand why the first 70 decimal places would be zero, but we're stuck on the next 50. Yes? You know, when Maxwell explained that electricity and magnetism, and especially light, I should better say light, when Maxwell explained that light was an oscillation of an electromagnetic field, physicists then spent decades worrying about what is a field and what is it oscillating in. And at the end of a long struggle, they learned that they shouldn't ask that question, because an oscillating field was simply the most deep thing they knew about. And they couldn't usefully explain it in terms of anything else. Now, having learned that lesson the hard way, we rest upon the experience of our predecessors who learned such lessons the hard way. So now I think I can tell you that, although we don't know for sure, it's very likely that our best theories that we have now, although we don't understand them very well yet, reinterpret matter in terms of strings. So, I'll have to tell you, as physicists eventually learned in the late 19th century, that the better part of valor is not to ask that kind of question, unless you're in a position to go to a much deeper theory that would give a real answer.
And isn't that a real paradigm change in the following sense? It seems to me that for years and years, physicists and other scientists kept looking down inside, finding smaller and smaller objects that made up the larger and larger objects we saw. And now it seems to me you're telling me we are at the end of this search because you're not going to tell us what a string is.
Well,
you would have been willing to tell us what a nucleus was,
yes,
or what a quark was, maybe.
Well, somebody...
strings, but you're now telling me you're going to stop.
No, I'm telling you that if there isn't a better theory, then it's not useful to ask what a string is made of. What it would mean to give a real answer to the question you asked. The question you asked is, what are strings made of? And what it would mean to answer that usefully would be to give a better theory. But I don't know whether there will be a better theory, but I suspect it will take at least another half a century to understand this one in a sensible way.
Is there any arbitrariness in the fact that you choose string because it's based on solution, now you probe what it is, and how do you think the string concept is?
Well, a version of your question is why strings and not, for instance, membranes,
right,
which I can't draw as well. So, the math works with strings, and it doesn't work in the same way with membranes. There's a subtle sense in which we've now discovered with duality that there are membranes as well as strings. But the strings are the first among equals in the sense that the membranes aren't. You can compute systematically with strings. You can systematically do with strings things that you can't do with the membranes. When I give colloquy to mathematicians or physicists, I like to give the analogy, but it's not really right in this audience, that when Cauchy and his contemporaries replaced the real numbers by the complex numbers, a complex number is made of two real numbers, and some must have asked, well, why two real numbers and not three, for instance? But there's nothing quite like this step. It's a precise analogy because the particle world line has one real number, and the tube has got two, like the complex numbers. I think that the main reason I personally suspect, you ask what degree of uniqueness is there, for instance, in succeeding in making quantum mechanics and gravity. Well, one thing that convinces me it's unique, especially with the discovery that the different theories are different parts of one elephant, is that all the sensible ideas that physicists have had turned out to be different aspects of this theory. Now, of course, that doesn't exclude the possibility that this theory is a branch of thought that has nothing to do with nature. And there's a completely different branch of thought that we haven't stumbled upon at all, that's more relevant. There are so many remarkable things, however, that go into making this theory work and making it look as much like nature as it does, that I would personally find that to be an amazing cosmic conspiracy. If things would, the question reminds me slightly of the fact that when the fossils were first studied historically, some interpreted them as records of life forms that existed in the past, and others thought that they'd been placed in the rocks at the creation of the world to test our faith.
Well, with that, perhaps you'll...